This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is Spoken Word on Joy, celebrating spoken word artists, poets, and creatives from Australia and abroad.
Welcome to another episode of Spoken Word on Joy 94.9, Joy Media. And today we are talking about, or today, tonight, wherever you're listening to us in podcast land, we're talking about The Dress, performed by the magnificent Werribee Park Mansion. Because that would be that's incredible. A mansion actually performing a play. So let's start that up already. Great, James. Performed at the magnificent Werribee Park Mansion. And we have the writer Elaine Beek with us today. Is that how I pronounce your name?
You see a lane like you walk down a lane. Yep. I get used to telling everybody that because it's so close to so many other names.
Yeah, so I walk down a lane, so it's Elaine Beek.
Beek. Yes.
Fantastic. And I can just detect a slight Scottish brogue.
Yes, I'm born in Scotland, Edinburgh, and I came out many years ago, so I've got a bit of a mixture of an accent now. When I go back to Scotland, they tell me I sound weirdly Australian, and then I've got a bit of a weird Scottish accent here, so I'm just weird.
Australians don't have an accent.
Yes, they do.
Well, we don't think we do.
Yeah.
This sounds very engaging play. So it's a story about two unlikely allies, a widow and her seamster, as they race to regain their spark of life. Performed in one of the grandest historic mansions in Australia and located next to Lancemore Mansion Hotel. I think I've been there once. And you're the writer, and I believe you're also acting in it as well.
Yes.
So do you find it difficult writing and acting in the same work?
Not really, because I'm very... If you have a good director, you trust them. And... I still put in ideas as we go along, but essentially I just trust the director and do what I'm told. So no, it's actually okay. A few things I have to let go, you know, a couple of things I'll hang on to and I was writing it because blah, blah, blah. But mostly Nigel Sutton was the director and he did a great job and I just totally respect him and yeah. He did it all.
Actors do like to change words, don't they?
Yes. This one's hard to change because it's quite wordy. So, we don't muck around with the dialogue very much. But it is a bit interactive with the audience as well. So Burton, the seamster or dressmaker, he does more interacting with the audience than I do. And he has a lot of fun with that. So he'll speak directly to them and react depending on what they give him back, which can be really funny.
It's always fascinating me when that sort of when you can have a work that you can sort of do that with, because it has to be very type of work. It's more of a darker play. You can't really interact with the audience that much. I found anyway. So
yeah, usually an audience is more comfortable if there's an element of humour in there. They feel safer, as opposed to you can't make an audience feel uncomfortable at all. And you learn quickly who's going to be receptive, and you keep it light, and you keep it, you move on quickly. So yeah.
And how long did it take you to work on a play?
Oh, about a year. It's always a long process, but I don't sit there at my desk for 8 hours a day doing it. So it's you get bursts of time and then you get dramaturgs or people to help you as you're going along. And then even when you start to actually play the parts, you change the script again. So it's an ever-developing process.
Yes, I've never met a writer who actually sits down at the desk 8 hours a day and writes. It's a myth that everyone says at every writer's festival. Oh, yes, I get up at 7 o'clock and go for a run, then I walk the dogs, then go for a swim in the beach, and then I have a thing. Everyone's thinking, bullshit.
Yeah, because when you're writing, you have to, it's like diving into a deep, deep, deep swimming pool. Because I always say writing a play is like, it's instructors It's, you've got your imagination of what the setting. In this case, it's easier because I knew it would be the mansion. Sometimes you don't even know the setting. So you're trying to think, how is this going to work? Because it's instructions to the actor and the director. It's not a direct communication with the audience. So, yeah, it's like writing sheet music. You have to test it and see how it sounds. Yeah.
This is, I'm reading the blurb for this play again. This sounds so incredible. It is 1899, Mrs. Hannah Bryden, the picture of respectable widowhood, has lived alone in the sprawling mansion. She enjoys nothing save the occasional company of her dressmaker, the flamboyant and sharp-tongued Mr. Burton. It's really, yeah, it's, I don't want to go too far into it, but spoilers, but this reads incredible. So the cast is of just, so it's you with cellist Patrick Schnorr. And you had
Scott Jackson plays Burton. Yeah.
So it's basically a three-hander or two-hander.
Yes. Well, we did actually have recorded music first, but then we just thought in the setting, let's get a live cellist. So we actually also have Laura Burns as well. So it's just depending on availability. But you can't beat a live cellist music. In a mansion, it's beautiful.
No, the acoustics alone would be amazing.
Yeah, it's haunting. It's just gorgeous.
It's like when you first time you ever see an orchestra together in a proper theatre, and they're sitting on the stage, not under it, and you can feel the vibrations through the floor. It's just like, oh.
Yeah, you can't match it with anything recorded. Yeah.
No, you can't really. It's just like it's because also because especially with string instruments, they're closer to the human voice than most other instruments.
Yeah.
So there is a sort of connection.
Resonance. Yeah, yeah.
So I had my nerdy music school student hat just jumped on. Sorry about that.
No, it's all good.
So so it's a seated performance in the grand hallway. And so it's, okay, so you have a glass of wine on entry as well, is it? Or?
No, at the end. So the audience, the setting is the grand hallway downstairs of the mansion. Yep. And so we traverse through the audience. So they're, we take maximum 32, so it's quite an intimate show. And that's restricted because of the size of the room. But we have, what's half of 32? 16 on 16 one side and 16 on the other. And then we move up and down between them. So, it's quite energetic and it's just a great story, I think.
So it's a 90-minute show?
Yeah. That includes, so upstairs, the costuming is fantastic. So we go upstairs in obviously our full costume and share a glass of sparkling wine or soft drink or whatever upstairs with the audience so they get to see the costumes up close and come say hello and, yeah.
That's quite fun. So it's Friday the 22nd, 23rd and 29th. And so it's the last two weekends of March. So That's a good way to spend the first part of Easter.
Yes, I know. If you're in Melbourne and visiting, it's the reason we chose. Well, I started working on this because I love the history. That 19th century history is fascinating, and it's that upstairs downstairs lifestyle that I think we're all there's so much. Like if you look on television, movies, there's so much done about it because it is you've got the two extremes of privilege in the one under the one roof, and how did that work? Well, eventually it didn't, especially in Australia. They said, "Nah, we're not doing that." And eventually, it stopped quite quickly when the Depression started. But during that time, that's when in Australia, because it's all based on history, the squatters obviously they could buy land really cheaply and build these amazing grand houses. And they needed, like at Werribee Park, they had about 30 servants just for a family of five. But then as privileged as they were, it wasn't all wonderful. And certainly for women, because they were like the character in this story, Hannah, she's just given life tenancy in the house. You don't actually own anything and one servant. So it's quite lonely, great big house, you know. And so that was the spark of the idea of the other side of being a wealthy, you know, widow was, well, here you are now. And, of course, her best friend becomes her dressmaker, Burton, who's, yeah.
Yeah, we do have a tendency to glamorize the sort of upstairs downstairs thing. Like, I mean, that there was a sitcom about it, and Downton Abbey and things like that. It's all very polished and all very restrained, but it's
yeah. And this, in fact, I just watched Zone of Interest in the movies, and I was watching one of the most powerful, impactful things for me was how they completely ignored the Jewish servant, and it's almost like she didn't exist, and how she just faded in and out, and how that would have felt for her. Yeah. And I think the reality is they weren't all friends. Yeah. You know, there would have been some, especially the ones that served the master of the house or the mistress. But that's where she was so lonely. She just attached herself to Burton, really. Yeah. And he was so, and he's so energetic and flamboyant. He's gay. And that's something it's in the play, it's all throughout the play. You kind of know that he is from the way he delivers it. Mm. But it's also dealt with in the play head on at one section. I won't give it away, but it's an inch, because we did a lot of research about that, how it was back in the 19th century for gay people, and how, where you were accepted and where you weren't, and how, you know, what you could do, all the rules.
Oh, yeah.
It was, yeah.
I mean, in Bendigo, where I'm from, the Gold Rush, there's lots of gay people, but they're always sisters or brothers who live together.
Yeah.
They're sisters, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
But then you read their diaries, and it's like, no, they're not sisters.
Yeah. And in some circles, it was actually accepted, and that was like, that it was almost cool to have a gay seamster, a gay dressmaker. It was allowed in that specific, but if you stepped out of it,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's also a funny thing with that as well. The if you were at Toff, you could get away with a lot of things.
Yeah,
like, yeah, it's like the Fabian Society with Oscar Wilde.
Yeah,
he would have got away with lots of things if he hadn't have started screwing around with the Marquis of and if he would have got through the court case if he hadn't have opened his mouth.
Yeah,
because they couldn't really sticking with anything, because he technically didn't do anything illegal.
Yeah.
Just he was arrogant in his court case. They got him. So, but
and that was his downfall, really, which is a tragic story, that one.
But Oscar Wilde not speaking and not being arrogant is just not going to happen.
No. Yes. The two went together. But yes. In the dress, the main theme is, it's really funny because we're doing, everything's turning on its head now, but department stores were opening up, and that's why I chose late 19th century, because it meant the end of work for dressmakers. Of course, and women, yeah. Like, I've got old photos of George's, gorgeous. So the women went in, and the fact they could try on different dresses, it was spectacular to them, and they were fussed over, and instead of, you know, so it was an opportunity to go out and interact, and they felt so special. But Burton is like, so Hannah loves this, and he absolutely is killing his livelihood. So, and it's funny now, department stores, some of them are shutting because of online shopping, you know, so the world changes. It's, yeah. So that's kind of the premise of the story, is that he is desperate to get her to a masquerade ball and make an absolutely stunning costume to try and show off what he can do and get some clients back. She doesn't want to go, and that's where the clashes and comedy and what happens.
Well, of course, she wants him all to herself.
Yes. Well, she just couldn't be bothered. She was so used to living in the house that even though she wasn't happy, she just didn't want to go out. But Harry Cornett is our dressmaker for the show, and he's also a genius in historical social etiquette in Australia, and, you know, even that's just, he's a master at it. So not only did he design and create this stunning dress, but he also, the nuances of the dialogue and what you would say, it was, you know, there's splashes of him throughout the play as well. So, yeah, he's amazing.
Sounds like a very collaborative effort.
Always. I always say I surround myself with people better than me.
You find that's how you theatre works better, if everyone is collaborating, even if it's the script's already written, but the actors will still contribute things.
Yeah, and I look at, again, it comes down to a really good director. Mm. So when you start, the writer, and, well, I chat clearly, is like, what I'm trying to say, what is the whole point of this, what how I see it. And then there's a point where you just then have to kind of hand it over, and you're now just one of the actors. So it takes, it's not easy to do, but if you can both do it, and there's a fine line, because I do some directing as well, you allow input because somebody might have a better idea than you, and often they do. So why would you not listen? So take it on board, and then does it work in what I'm trying to do? If it does, great. If not, or try it. Half the time you try and go, well, that was a dumb idea, wasn't it?
I'm going through that at the moment with my own play. So, so it's quite hard for writers to let them cut things.
Yeah.
Especially, but
oh, that's, you've just hit the nail on the head, actually. That's one of the hardest things.
Yeah.
I put a lot of effort into something that I think is so important. And specifically with this play, Nigel will say, it doesn't serve anything to add this. It's just a feel. It's just, so I have to let it go. And he would be right, you know. So it makes it more, so there's no line wasted in the whole play.
And you sometimes find yourself realizing that you were trying to be more clever than you needed to be.
Yeah. Yes, spot on. Yes, it
so just. If my actors are listening to this.
Yeah. And it is. You get ahead of yourself and you start going, this would be good to say this and this would be good. And but then it's not serving really what you're, the whole point of it.
So. Yeah. And then you realize that the entire line, the entire slab of lines could just be reduced to 5 or 6 word sentence.
And sometimes even just a gesture. Yeah. Like sometimes not even dialogue at all.
Mm.
And you, it's more powerful in the watching them, how they react, as opposed to spelling it out. I'm still learning.
it is an interesting learning curve, giving your work to actors. And that line from Ginsberg is true about killing your darlings.
Yeah.
You have to kill your darlings for it to work.
Yeah, so true.
It's painful as hell. But
I know.
I can see why a lot of writers end up not doing a lot of stage or screen work, because it,
I remember once, I hope he never listens to this, but I remember once listening to David Williamson on the ABC years ago, and I think he was saying when he wrote, he didn't interact with actors, watch it in development. He was very confident that was the end of the play. And apparently, I don't know which play it was, but the director said, it's just the scene's not working. And he goes, well, just direct, that's your job to fix. And he'd come back, no, we have to change. So he went back in and he went, oh, damn, they're right. And he said in that, as I said, it was many years ago, that he now always does the development with live actors. I hope I got that right. But I'm sure he said that. Yeah.
I'm sure if I'm sure you got it right, but if you didn't, I'm sure someone will tell
us. Yeah, and it was a long time ago. So, yeah, he's obviously a brilliant playwright.
I can see that point, actually, because when I was doing dramaturgy and things like that, I was always told just, a script should be able to be handed to anyone and they should be able to direct it. But then that's not always the case, because there's certain things that should be worked out sometimes, I think.
Yeah. So, oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, and the director's got to love the play, I guess, in some way, or connect with it really deeply. Definitely. You know, so they want to say something as well, and or they see something that you haven't even thought of, and they, drill down into that, so it becomes that's the beauty of playwriting and developing.
I think I find the beauty of it mostly is watching actors develop your characters.
Yeah.
And especially if you're writing something that's personal, and you see actors give birth to it, and it's like, wow, I didn't even see it that way.
Yeah.
It sort of no longer becomes your story, it becomes more shared.
Well, that's the whole point of doing theatre is you're giving something to the audience, and they can all take different things out of it, and different meanings and different interpretations, and some have light bulb moments, and some, and that's the exciting part. Everybody reads different things into it, and the job of it is not to dictate what it is, but let people discover, somehow.
There are certain things that you never even think of when you're writing, like blocking.
Oh, yes.
It's my new favourite word for the actors out there. I now know what it means.
Ah.
I think.
Yeah.
I think.
Yes.
I always thought blocking was like blocking a shot in, but no.
No, no, it's, yeah. Oh, I can't do that because you exited him three lanes ago. Yeah. So you've got to bring him back onto the stage.
But if the couch is there, how are they getting into the room?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's all the writing nerds out there going, what?
Yeah.
But I've always thought that writers should learn how to act. Also, they should study acting. Because I think they become better writers that way. Like, yeah. If you were reading Uta Hutton books or Howard Fine, things like that, I think if you learn those, if you read those sort of texts, you can sort of understand how an actor approaches a character a bit better, and you can sort of shape your writing better, I think.
Yeah, and having direct experience in all of writing, acting, and directing helps, I think, in doing any of them, actually, because they all connect so deeply when you're in the creative process. Yeah, having an intimate understanding, even if you're not a professional actor, but having a deep understanding of it just makes the work richer, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it does. I occasionally do extras work from movies and short films and student films, and it's helped my writing a little bit, I think, because I understand the process and feasibility of doing things, and no one has any money in this country to do anything.
Yes, I know. Yeah, that's so. The challenge.
Oh, we don't need a costume designer for the play. Just wear your own clothes. It's
fine. Yeah. Well, I did a play, Jack and Millie, which was about my breast cancer journey. I did that 2021. Actually got in the studied the VC drama curriculum, and we didn't have any funding. Our set was two white boxes, but yet we had doctor's clinic, a park, a coffee shop, a restaurant, and we just then choreographed the movement of the boxes, and the audience immediately got where we were. But so it was very clever, but it was out of desperation. So I don't know if it was clever or just like, how are we going to figure this out?
I need to take notes on this because I'm doing the same thing at the moment, because I'm using scenery from the actual theatre. I'm using your own couches.
Yeah.
Because that's also because it's at the Butterfly Club. There's no way in hell I can get a couch up there.
Yes.
It's like,
yeah.
Has anyone seen those stairs?
Yeah.
You can't. So.
Well, I did Vivaldi's part that I did with a youth group. We had... as long as the audience, we had a park bench and a tree that I got from Bunnings. It was a little, and it was set in a park. Mm. And again, we just like, how do you hone in? What's important? Mm. And a good play shouldn't need a set, really.
Yes, I've heard a lot of people say that. And
but it's good to have one. So.
Because you can interpret things. Because a play is primarily a conversation between the actor and the audience. Anyway, I think. And it's as long as the audience understands what's going on, and you can, and the acting is good and the writing is hopefully good, you can sort of, you don't need a lot of dressing on it.
Yeah, well, even with Jack and Millie, Nigel actually, Sutton, he directed that too, and he wanted all clutter removed. And that was, he said, from the beginning. And we wanted to mime things. We weren't even allowed to do that. So it was like, oh, you felt completely stripped, you know, bare. It was amazing. And we never left the stage. So and it was then, because there was no hints of what was to come, there was no, you know, sometimes like, where am I in a park or a coffee shop? And, you know, but then you just knew through the story where I'm going. So we managed, just two boxes and us.
It sounds like a very fun play to watch.
It was a comedy too.
Yeah, I sometimes watch a lot of in indie theatre. I think they've spent way too much time and effort on the scenery.
Yeah. It's nice to walk in and see an amazing set.
If you
have the budget.
Yeah.
When you haven't got it, like so many artists, you know, you have to be so. There's a different creativity, obviously, in building and designing a set.
Definitely.
And like, because even right now, I'm trying to figure out one in a prison, and how do I also do inside the cell, but outside the cell? And my thing is, because I never have any funding, is how can I do it simply? Will two poles be enough? Will that be enough? You know, and it can be more powerful, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, but lighting is. If you have access to good lighting, that really helps.
Yes. That reminds me, we haven't done our technical run yet. Anyway, thanks.
I have to come and see you play.
Well, it's we actually clash with two of your nights.
Oh no!
Because I'm on the 8th. We're on the 18th until the 23rd. So.
Oh well, you just come to the second weekend and 18th.
Yeah, so next Monday. So so we've basically got a week. So.
Okay, we'll talk about this.
Well, I'm actually carrying a dragon on at Easter anyway. So in Bendigo, so I'm always away at Easter. So.
Okay.
So it's a Bendigo thing. So so you've worked with Nigel before?
Yes.
Have you worked with the other crew and staff before?
Scott Jackson, we worked on a play that is actually the only one I've never produced. It's Shepherd Kings, and it's based on the Churnside, three main family members in the Churnside family who owned and built the mansion. So Thomas, Mary and Andrew, their trio, and it's a much deeper. I do a play, What Was That?, which is more a light comedy about the history. This one delves much more deeply into their psyche, and it's a drama about their lives. And so Scott was played my son in that play. I think we've actually got rid of that character in the second draft. So I got to know him quite well. I've also seen him perform, and he's absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
Just a quick another writing question. Just when you got rid of a character or got rid of a scene, do you end up having to go back through it and realise, oh, I don't need those other scenes anymore?
Well, you have to.
Yeah.
And they realise, oh, no, this doesn't make sense because he would do... Yeah, so it's like it's tapestry. You pull a thread and it affects the whole thing.
Well, to make mine to be an hour, because it's one act, I had to remove two characters. And then had to overhaul everything.
Yeah.
Because those two characters were very important, because they were linchpins for other things and they were stepping off points for other things. So
yeah.
Yeah, it's like, wow, that's a lot more work than I realised.
Yeah. And it's also costing. Like if you're planning to tour a play, and that, again, it's a very, that's the business side of it that is a little frustrating, because it would be nice to have all those characters. But yeah, once, if you want to tour a play, or it, yeah, and you're paying everybody. It's also a very practical cost thing, because
And most plays in Melbourne or the Victorian scene anyway don't really have more than four characters anyway, because of that reason.
That's probably why.
Yeah, it's they're not musicals, and it's not Shakespeare.
Yeah.
So no one's got the money for 20 people.
Yeah, that's it.
And probably like at least 300 crew and everything else.
So. Yes.
Sorry, this is something very depressing, but live theatre in Melbourne is amazing because it's done on a shoestring. So.
Yes. The smell of an oily rag or a shoestring,
And once you find people who are committed to the sort of idea you have or the sort of narrative you want to tell, it's amazing what you can achieve, I think.
Yeah. I think I'm working on a new play right now. The working title is The Yellow Line, which got the Malcolm Robertson Foundation grant write that one with. So I'm doing it with Māori Performing Arts Group. It's Ngamatai Purua, so NMP. And I'm working with Bernie Lee Edwards, so she, Nana, I call her, she's referred to. And it's probably one of the most challenging, joyful, exciting, scary things I've ever worked on, because it's not my story at all, but I'm so invested in it. But I just shut up and listen when they say it's set in a prison, and it's based on a true story, and you can't beat the joy of working with somebody when you're both, you know, got the same goals and the same aims, and one goes, what about that? What about that? Oh, right, we'll do this. No, you know, it's time just goes like a blink, and then you go, oh, well, that was good.
I know what you mean. It's like when you realize, oh, that doesn't work, but this will work better.
Yeah.
That's such an amazing thing, because you realize you've cut down on minutes.
Yeah. And then you go, could we do this? And they go, yeah, let's do that. All right, how do we do this? And yeah, it's really exciting. And it's for this play, it's about finding the truth as well, which is not, it sounds trivial, but it's, now, what are we really saying? Because sometimes, like you said before, you try and be too clever, and that's a trip, where it's like, to me, if an audience is listening, they resonate with truth, whatever that yes. truth is, and they'll instinctively pick up when it's not. And it's like hearing a bung note. You might not know, well, that was a, should have been an F sharp and it's an F or whatever, yeah. but you just know it's, there's something not right here. And I think that's always the challenge. It doesn't have to be truth. If you know, it doesn't have to be, it could be a fantasy story, but it still has to feel true. I don't know. I think I'm babbling now.
No,
but,
I know,
it doesn't mean every play has to be based on a true story, but there's it has to be.
Authenticity.
Yes, somewhere in that, even if you're talking about a dragon.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
I think that's why, like, a lot of young women and some men are Swifties, because they find a connection with her and authenticity. Same with people found with the Beatles or any sort of music. People find a connection. They may not be... That's why people like stuff that's, like, it's not earth-shattering or it's not that philosophical, but it's emotionally it connects.
Yep. Some of the best songs also have three chords.
Yes.
Like, it's... Yeah.
I mean, there are only seven notes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all. Yeah, like, how many early Beatles songs only have three notes?
Yeah.
Or three chords, sorry.
Yeah.
And it's... Yeah, it's just how you do them.
Yep.
It's like, it's like with sonnets or with any sort of... like, because they're like Spenserian, Elizabethan, Pindaric. There's lots of different types of sonnets.
Mm-hmm.
And they may be formulaic, but they work.
Yeah.
And they, because they're able to tell a love story or an emotional story or get to the essence of something very quickly.
So. And Shakespeare, I'm not a Shakespeare expert, in fact, far from it, but when... He was a genius because he just got people, you know, he just, and how he articulated how, what they would be feeling or what they would, just genius. I would love to have been an audience back then because they understood the audiences back then. He was always performing to, it was all about performing to the audience. Yeah. It was never to be self-indulgent or da-da-da.
Or hoity-toity, yeah.
Yeah, and so, yeah, and they would try and connect with the audience and they got the dialogue. Like, like for me, I have to read the synopsis first if I haven't seen the play before and I have to understand, otherwise I can get a bit lost. But
I had the same problem with Shakespeare, but it's also because the language is 500 years old.
Yeah,
and,
of course,
and we don't,
yeah.
I mean...
We don't normally speak... Exactly, it's like almost not another language, but yeah, it's not...
Yeah. I also think Shakespeare is ruined by the fact that everyone does it in a Victorian style, because he's not Victorian. He is very rough and ready. He's from an estuary area.
Yeah.
So Stratford is not the middle of London. It is a very rough area. And you can tell by the way things are structured. And even the way, like the old joke with hours, the way that he wrote hours is not the way we write hours. It's H-O-R-E.
Ah.
So there's jokes in there, hour after hour or whore after whore. So a lot of those jokes don't work anymore.
Yeah.
Because the way the English language changes. So.
It develops, yeah.
I mean, I have the same problem with Chaucer, though. So
yeah.
It's hard to read.
So but this you'll understand. The dress you'll understand.
Well, it's late 19th, early 20th century set in Melbourne, so we should be able to understand it very easily.
Yes. Yeah,
and so as I did say, it's a 90-minute performance, and there's no interval with it.
No, yes, because you're the play goes for an hour and 20 minutes, about that, and then we take you upstairs, and the glasses are already set up there, as I said, and it's a lovely sharing bit at the end for photos, and in fact, I had a clever idea because I didn't want to. It wasn't a clever idea. I thought it was. I thought I won't take photos of the dress and images and post them because I want it to be a surprise. And of course, the first night we did it, everybody took photos, and I thought, well, that was a waste of time, wasn't it? But we still try and, because it is. Harry took a year to make the dress, and everything is handmade, even the corset.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's quite incredible. Yeah.
So I'm guessing it's not used with bone or ivory, though.
Yeah, no. Yeah, but even horsehair in the front of the dress, so it actually perfectly keeps the front perfectly straight. So he did the historical correctness there. And I think, Harry, if you're listening, I'm really sorry, but I think that's it. But on our website, it actually tells you about the making of the dress, because a lot of people ask about it. So there's a whole section in the program on the make, on the actual making of the costuming.
And that's at Essence Theatre
dot Productions. Essence Theatre dot Productions, yeah.
Slash the dress, and there's also hyphen dress, and there's bookings as well on that page as well.
Yeah, everything. So the dot productions, Essence Theatre dot Productions is a website. As soon as you open it, you'll see the dress, bookings, click on the dress, the program's there. It's, we try to make it easy.
Well, all that information will be up on the podcast when I do it anyway, so people can just link. After they listen. So would you like to discuss anything else that you're working on at the moment? Or?
I think I've pretty much have mentioned the yellow line, and yeah, I think the only thing is I did say when I walked in, I see your poster says
Out Loud and Proud.
Out Loud and Proud, and I run a youth program once a year called Say It Out Loud. And I thought next time I do that, I've got to talk about it here.
Definitely.
Because the idea is getting people to tell their own stories, young people. And I've learnt more from them than I think anything else, because they have less filters, I find.
No. Which is good, I think.
Yeah, fantastic. That's what, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
if you want honesty, always talk to someone a lot younger than you.
Yeah, they'll just go, but, yeah. So, yeah, I would love people to come and see the dress and support our little independent theatre.
Thank you for being on the show today. And please, everyone, support local independent theatre in Melbourne, because it needs your support. Don't forget, if it wasn't for the arts, none of us would have got through COVID.
True.
So, thank you so much for coming on today, and I hope to see you next time.
Thank you, James.
So the dress originally has a four-day run period. Are there any other dates available for the dress?
Yeah, so we're this run March 22nd, 23rd, 29th, 30th, but we will be doing other shows. The idea is to keep it regularly on at Werribee Park. Maybe, and we're not sure yet, maybe once a month, but our website, we do another show there every weekend all year round. So the dates are always on our website. So if you check it out, we always list what's coming up a good, at least a month or so ahead.
That sounds great with a show like that, because everyone would really want to see the dress.
Absolutely.
So, and are there other shows with in the same place or the same?
Yes. So we do Werribee Park in the Werribee Park Mansion. We also run What Was That, which is a completely different show to the dress. It's a roaming play, and it's a historical scary comedy. Big focus on the comedy. Like, we don't take the scary. It's not. It's fun scary, but it's based on the story of the Chirnside family, and you get taken, the actors take you throughout the house to the different rooms.
Fantastic. And that's all on the website as well?
All on the website.
And ticket prices and details are also on the website, and you'll be able to follow them on the link on this podcast. So thanks again for coming in, and it sounds like a fantastic show.
Thank you, James.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.